Last time we left you, we were talking about the Queen of Castile, Juana, who was carting her dead husband, the ambitious and consistently unfaithful Felipe the Handsome, around the countryside of her kingdom. The year 1506, 1507, the situation confusing to say the least. Juana was supposed to accompany the body of her deceased husband to Granada in the south of Spain and bury it in the cathedral, but instead she and her entourage just kind of meandered throughout the kingdom while she allegedly fondled his decaying body from time to time, wept incessantly, traveled only by night, and exhibited many more signs of what might be considered to be a serious mental breakdown. And we mentioned this because this was sort of the main story that has been passed down over the generations to this day and has been used to explain why she became known in history as Juana la Loca or Joanna the Mad. Was this really true? Well, a more recent analysis of the facts suggests it probably wasn't, and at the very most was an exaggerated misrepresentation of what was really going on. She may have had issues, but she was also the object of a very nasty smear campaign, and an effective one too, because 500 years later, we still call her that name, despite it being entirely unfair. For example, Juana was said to visit her dead husband's tomb frequently from the time of his death in September 1506 to December of that very same year when she embarked on this infamous journey. We're talking about basically every day and constantly wanting the tomb to be open so she could gaze at his body. That's the story I'm telling you. This was happening in the city of Burgos in the north of Spain, and specifically in the Charterhouse Monastery outside the town. She was reported to have requested the casket to be opened, and she would stare at her beloved deceased spouse and on occasion caress his lifeless body. The real story apparently could not be further from the truth. She did ask to see the body, but only twice, and this was 2 months apart. The first time was apparently done to ensure he was there, as there was a rumor or a fear that his body had been taken away and returned to his native land of Flanders, which is Belgium. His heart was taken to his homeland, that we do know, but Felipe had requested in his will that he be buried in Granada. Since this was a time where basically no one trusted anyone and everyone was suspicious of everyone else, she basically just wanted to make sure. And it's also quite possible that she wanted to give one final goodbye, and there's nothing crazy about that. The casket was opened for a second time in December, but once again, there was a reason for this. Juana wanted to leave, but she was told that she could not take Felipe with her because, according to the church, you had to wait 6 months before you could move a body to another place. But she ignored their demand and planned on leaving anyway. But just to double check, before departing, she took a peek to make sure everything was where it was supposed to be. Was that a crazy idea? Not at all. I mean, after all, we check and recheck things all the time before leaving on a trip. How often do we actually make visible contact with our passports, just to be on the safe side? All the more reason when we're talking about a corpse. So there's an example of this famous story not really being accurate at all. And that's just the beginning. The seemingly aimless nature of this trip provided her foes with plenty of ammunition. But maybe it wasn't as aimless as people think. And that leads us to the question, why would she set off on a journey that seemed to be going nowhere? Well, it seems that there was more method behind the madness than people have given her credit for. One problem may have had to do with health, and since we're in the middle of a pandemic, we can relate to it. The bubonic plague had broken out in many parts of Castile. In fact, some historians attribute Felipe's death to this disease. Burgos was one of the most affected cities, so they decided to move out to safer environs. This would happen again when they're in Torquemada, where the outbreak of the Black Death prompted them to leave the town almost immediately. So we know for a fact that this was having an impact on the trip. The other reason was pure politics, and this is going to require a kind of lengthy explanation, but it helps understand the context, and I also think it's very interesting. You see, Juana's capacity to rule was questioned long before. And we also know that some individuals were using this uncertainty to their advantage. We know her mother had her doubts and added a proviso in her will for Fernando to step in if she couldn't perform her duties. She wasn't saying that her daughter was nuts. She was just saying that she didn't know if she could handle the job. We also know that her husband played on her fits of jealousy to point out her instability. And we know that her father, after Isabel died, used her supposed instability to claim that he was co-ruler of Castile. He actually had coins made with him and her as co-rulers of Castile. So he was very serious about it. In fact, Felipe, Juana's husband, had to intervene and tell Fernando to back off because he was the rightful king. And he was right. Fernando gave in mainly because he knew he had little chance of getting away with it. And even though he didn't think much of Felipe, at least someone other than Juana was running the show in Castile. Now, of course, few were taking Juana's opinion into account. She was the true queen, and yet she was being overlooked all the time. On the other hand, she was probably just happy her husband was with her and not with any of his lovers. But anyway, Felipe went ahead and died 3 months later, throwing the whole plan out the window and provoking a major crisis. What was going to happen? Well, Fernando felt he was the logical choice to act as regent, but he was in Naples, Italy at the time, which belonged to his kingdom, the Kingdom of Aragon, and was busy resolving matters there, so he couldn't come back. That left us with the famous Cardinal Cisneros, the most powerful man of the church in Spain at the time. The personal confessor of Queen Isabel wanted Fernando to take over, but in the meantime, he arranged it so that he would assume the role of regent of Castile until a decision was made about what to do with Juana. His active role in government might surprise some, but back then, high-ranking religious officials were major players in politics. But it doesn't end there. There was also the Habsburg family, Felipe's family, who realized that Carlos, Juana and Felipe's son, is the direct heir to both the thrones of Castile and Aragon. And that's a pretty interesting addition to their possessions, because Castile is the country expanding into the Indies, into the Americas, and Aragon will give him the rest of Spain, as well as the lower half of Italy. Not bad. And then you have the opponents of the Habsburgs, who fear that this foreign family will not act in the best interest of Castile. And finally, you have Juana of Castile. Remember Juana? She, despite the opposition, was doing her best to hold on to power, a power that was rightfully hers. And she was saying to Cisneros, hold on, I'm queen here, I'm calling the shots, you're not going to tell me what to do. So, that should give you an understanding of the complexity of the situation, and it probably goes deeper than that, because there may have been some legitimate reasons for doubting Juana's suitability for the job. There may have been some legitimate causes for concern. She lacked the experience. She was going through a very rough time on a personal level. Her character may have been unpredictable. Heck, she didn't even have the full backing of her own mom. So in addition to all this power grabbing, we can't rule out that maybe Fernando and Cisneros genuinely believed it was a big mistake to let her rule on her own. But then again, let's not ignore the fact that she was a woman. And most likely, machismo played a significant role. Isabel, her mother, was one of the most effective rulers of her day, but she was also kind of an anomaly. I would even venture to say that if Juana had been called Juan, that is, she was a man, this would have been a very different story. But anyway, Cisneros realizes he's caught. There's only so much he can do, unless, of course, he can convince others that she is really incapacitated. So basically, the current thinking is that just about everything and anything Juana did during that trip that seemed off, or even if it wasn't, was magnified to prove to the world that she was not the person to be there. It's a tactic that's been employed throughout the ages, and it's still used today. So this really shouldn't surprise anyone. On the other hand, it should be noted that the fact that an influential figure as Cisneros would have such a difficult time trying to persuade others of her madness might mean that those others didn't see it that way. Basically, they didn't see her as being as crazy as he wanted them to believe. So there you have it. Juana, on December 20th, 1506, dissolves the courts and says, I'm out of here, and she hits the road. The journey has become famous because of the alleged bizarre behavior associated with Juana. They claim she was traveling only at night, and that was just a plain weird thing to do. It is true that some of the traveling was nocturnal, but it's also true that Juana said that she was doing this because she felt it was unbecoming of a queen to be seen mourning. To some, this was an indication of madness. To others, logical reasoning for PR reasons. And it's been done all the time. Franklin Delano Roosevelt's use of a wheelchair during the end of his term in office until his death was fiercely kept from the public to avoid undermining confidence during a critical moment in history. And no one is calling him loco. On top of that, that doesn't seem to be the full story. There is documented evidence that she did travel during the day, and back then traveling in the dark was not as unusual as people have made it out to be, especially in the summer months. She is also reported to have refused to allow her husband's casket rest in a convent out of jealousy of all the women nuns who lived there. Today, scholars see this version as an evil attempt to make her look nutty. Recent interpretations argue that she was more likely concerned about the appropriateness of all the male guards who would have to stand by the coffin being within a stone's throw of so many young cloistered females who might have been tempted to take advantage of the one opportunity that came up, and vice versa. Anyway, back to this famous trip. Her first stop was in Torquemada, about 70 kilometers away from Burgos. And why did she stop there? Well, in part to have a baby. We forgot to mention that Juana was pregnant this whole time, with their last child. She would be born on January 14th, 1507. And her name was Catalina, or Catherine, after her aunt, the famous Catherine of Aragon, who was married to Henry VIII. The kingdom was very excited about this, but soon Cisneros and company would catch up to her, and he was dead set on keeping her under his control. The last thing he wanted was for her to make it to Andalusia, where she had a lot of support and where Fernando was generally disliked. But Juana was going nowhere in the short term. She was weak from from labor and from giving birth, and some even feared for her life, though she managed to recover. The royal group stayed in Torquemada for about 4 months until the appearance of the plague, which would force them to depart again. They didn't go very far. The new town, a fairly ordinary town called Hornillos, was just 6 kilometers away, but it was good enough, and there they hung out for another 4 months. They left again and stopped in yet another small and unassuming community called Tortoles de Esqueba. It's also in the province of Burgos. This was sort of the odd thing that was happening because these were small places, there was not much going on, progress was slow, and the kingdom was in need of strong leadership. If Juana was trying to give the impression that she was in control of the situation, she wasn't doing a very good job of it. It's almost as if she was trying to buy time, trying to dodge her enemies. But Spain needed something more. You see, the current state of Castile was somewhat dire. The country was beginning to fall into disarray. There were uprisings in Andalusia. The plague was raging. The economy was suffering, although it seems like it's always suffering. And let's not forget that Castile was in the midst of a major period of expansion in the Americas. On top of that, Juana was still mourning the loss of her husband, had just had a baby. In fact, some scholars haven't ruled out that postpartum depression as yet another contributing factor to her inaction. And all the time, people are starting to second guess her. And it was at this point that even some of her supporters were beginning to wonder if she was up to the challenge. So, Fernando was called in to do something about it. He had been in Italy fighting for Aragon's dominions there and finally returned to put things back into order. So both father and daughter met in this town of Tortoles to discuss the situation, and it is here that Juana agrees to let her father take over the business. But she must remain queen. Now, why would she do that? Why would she give up her control? Is this proof that she admitted that she was crazy or loca? Not necessarily at all. In fact, this was a fairly meditated decision. In all likelihood, she was just exhausted. She was tired of all the infighting, and power grabbing. And plus, it was her father who was taking over, a person of confidence, well, at least so she thought. So she said, okay, but she was smart enough not to give up everything because she knew had she done that, her son Carlos might have lost his right to take over later on down the road. So anyway, she retains her title, but loses her power. And instead of going onwards to Granada, she does an about face and heads back towards Burgos, right to where she started from. The reason for this is not another bout of insanity, but rather a conscious decision to settle her court in a major city, as her father suggested, and the closest one was Burgos. But she stops short. She stays in a town called Arcos, which is outside Burgos, and she doesn't go into the city. Why? Well, going into a walled city like Burgos might mean never coming out if they decide to detain her. So that would have been a bad idea. This may have been a result of paranoia or a shrewd plan to avoid getting cornered by her enemies. It seems like it was the latter, as we will soon see. By this time, Fernando had the support and legal right to run the country, but he had to act carefully because Juana was still queen and still popular. So he let her be, and for about 10 months she stayed in Arcos in what would probably be her most peaceful moment during these sort of crazy times. She didn't have to take care of official business, and she could go about her life basically stress-free, which is probably what she really needed. It's also at this point that Fernando begins to behave in a way that only aggravates the situation. He decides to take her son, also named Fernando, from her and raise him under his guidance. He would have been about 5 years old at that time. This sets Juana off spinning into another period of emotional turmoil, resulting in the loss of the confidence of many of her servants, and she responds by basically going into a hunger strike. Now, this is bad news for Fernando because the last thing he wants is for Juana to die. But don't think it's out of love for his daughter. Once again, it's politics. You see, Fernando never liked her husband Felipe, but once he was out of the way, he managed to get things under his control. But with Juana as queen, if she dies, her son Carlos, who's about 7 years old then, would inherit both the crowns of Castile and Aragon, his kingdom of Aragon. The fact that Carlos was born in Flanders and had been raised in Flanders irritated him. He wasn't a big fan of the Flemish or its world. This was something he did not want to happen, but he needed time to do something about it. One idea was for his grandson Fernando, the one he had taken from Juana's arms, to be raised under his tutelage and be a sort of Spanish option to take over one day. But it was sort of a long shot because Carlos, his brother, was still around, and it would be difficult to secure a right to the throne. So anyway, that was a plan B. Plan A was actually to have another son. That would give him a direct heir to the crown of Aragon and get Carlos out of the way, which was his main aim. So he married a French woman, the granddaughter of Louis XII. Her name was Germaine de Foix. She was 18 at the time, and he focused, I'll put it that way, on the matter of succession. They did have one baby, a son, in 1509. His name was Juan, and his birth meant the separation of the two crowns. Fernando's plan had paid off, but it was short-lived, and I mean very short-lived. Just a few hours later, Juan died, returning everything to status quo. And they never had another child, although word has it Fernando made a very earnest effort to conceive again. So much so that some say it contributed to his death, which was in 1516. Germaine, by the way, stayed in the picture and would have a child, a girl, named Isabel of Castile. Who was the father? Well, it's a story I've told before, but it's well worth telling again. When Fernando died, his grandson Carlos eventually took over. Fernando, knowing the game was up, apparently wrote a letter to his grandson and future king, to please make sure that his wife, Germaine, who was 27 at the time, was well taken care of. And boy did he ever. Carlos arrived when he was 17 and eventually entered into a romantic affair with this woman who was officially his step-grandmother. And together they would have a baby, Isabel of Castile. You just can't make this stuff up. Anyway, you can check that podcast out for more detail. But that's that. Getting back to Juana, Fernando makes sure she gets nursed back to health, and allows her to leave Argos with her dead husband and daughter Catalina so that they could go to Granada again. In 1509, they stop in Tordesillas, 150 kilometers away, which was a pretty important town back then. They stay in the royal palace. It's no longer there. And it's there that Fernando apparently takes further steps to rein in his, what he considers to be, lost daughter. He also probably doesn't like the fact that there are two heads of state moving around and wants to clear things up. There, Juana is more or less kept in involuntary confinement for basically the rest of her life. It's funny because some sources will actually say her final years, but the fact is she doesn't die until 1555, so those final years really comprise 46 years. Felipe, the body, would stay in the nearby convent of Santa Clara for an undetermined period of time, and then was finally transferred to his final resting place in Granada at an unspecified date. This is true. No one seems to know the answer to it, but it seems likely to have occurred sometime before 1516. In any event, Juana continued to go about her life in the palace with her daughter Catalina, who by this time was basically her one pride and joy left in life. But there would be a couple of crucial episodes where things could have changed dramatically for her and the country. First, there was the death of Fernando, leaving the crown officially to Juana. This is interesting because even though the crown of Spain as one unit did not exist, Juana, in a certain way, would be considered to be the first official monarch of both main crowns at the time, and as such, the first queen of Spain. But the fact is, the crowns were separate entities in terms of jurisdictions, so it's not really true. On top of that, our friend Cardinal Cisneros is back in the picture, and he is named regent once again until Carlos comes from Flanders. Cisneros actually died just before they were supposed to meet. In any event, Carlos, her son, comes to claim both crowns, as was his right. Aragon is easier because he was the legal heir, but Castile was different. There he had to ensure that his mother would agree to allow him to co-rule, and he would take care of the governing of the country like his grandfather had. When Carlos finally comes to Spain in 1517, the first thing he did was basically beeline it to Tordesillas to visit Mom, whom he hadn't seen since he was four. There must have been a genuine desire to see her again, but there was also a need to check out and see how everything stood regarding the succession. While Juana was symbolically the supreme authority in the land, it seemed few considered her to be a serious candidate by then. Carlos was, to all effects, a foreigner who knew little about the culture or the language of the land he would reign over. The first steps towards winning his subjects over was a full endorsement from his mother. If, in any way, she hadn't backed him, he would have been in a very compromised situation. There are those who say she was against this idea of him becoming king, and it's possible she may not have been delighted with the idea of being brushed aside again, but at least it was her son who was taking over, and she probably felt it was for the best. Future events would basically confirm this. Carlos couldn't have gotten off to a worse start. He had just been named Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, and he went to Germany to accept the crown, but he wanted the Spanish to foot the bill for the trip. This enraged many of those who already were suspicious of him, so they took advantage of his absence and started several major revolts. In Castile, it was called the Comonero Revolt, and it took place from 1520 to 1522. One of their aims was to make Spain Spanish again, so to speak, and to achieve this, they felt that Juana should be granted full governing powers. So they went to Tordesillas to present her with the proposal. Juana most likely gave it some thought, but in the end she was convinced that second-guessing Carlos's role as King of Castile would have led to the country spinning out of control, so she refused to sign anything that would have removed Carlos from power. That tells us two things. She was all right with not running the country, and she was using some pretty sound thinking, that's for sure. This was not a decision made by an insane mind. Carlos thanked his mother's loyalty by basically shutting her in the palace for good. He basically carried on with the policy his grandfather had implemented years before and kept her far away from politics. Juana was supervised by the infamous Francisca Enriquez, the Marquise of Denia, who had wheedled her way into the royal court and doesn't seem like she was a very nice person. Authoritarian by nature, she was like one of those nightmare governesses. She and her team of 12 helpers kept Juana under constant watch and under strict control. Once again, Juana's instability proved a pretext to basically treating her as they wished. In 1524, Carlos would commit another act of what is certainly one of the most painful. He removed the only daughter who lived with her, his sister Catalina, and sent her to be married in Portugal. On one hand, this was standard procedure for a royal house, and to be fair, Catalina probably needed a change of scene, but it removed from Juana's life the last vestige of family. It was a terrible blow and made her lonelier, more isolated, more depressed, and more dispirited than ever. Her mental health would only deteriorate further. As the years went by, the rigid confinement she was subjected to was eased, but by then the damage had been done. All the same, visits from family and friends were fairly frequent. Children and grandchildren made a point of it to stop and spend a few days with her when they could. Further evidence in my mind that she was not as ill as they say. In 1536, Carlos and his family spent the Christmas holidays with her for the first and only time. Still, it would mark one of her happiest moments of the later period in her life. The very final years were supposedly rough ones for her. This time, we may really be talking about a serious decline. But after all those years of being shut up in one building, could we really expect another outcome? Juana would die on April 12th, 1555. It was Good Friday, at the age of 78, a ripe old age for that period. Her son would survive her by only 3 years. Her remains are in the Cathedral of Granada, next to Felipe's. By this time, Spain had become the first global empire in the world and would remain on center stage for centuries to come. Juana of Castile, if you look at the bigger picture, was an insignificant figure in Spanish history in terms of her impact on politics, the economy, and other matters, and her low profile probably would have stayed that way if it hadn't been for her name, that darn old La Loca. In the 19th century, renewed interest of the figure of the woman came through literature and art. There were paintings of her deranged journey around Castile, the story of the woman who had this uncontrolled love for her husband, leading to insanity, would take root, and it's been all but impossible to change that story ever since. On the other hand, ironically, she did have a major impact on the direction of Spain during a crucial moment in its history, if only because she stayed on board the whole time and guaranteed the survival of the dynasty. So we have seen how Juana, even early on, was the concern of people like her mother, her husband, and her father, where the twists and turns of life most likely thrust her into a situation she probably didn't want and maybe was ill prepared for. That doesn't mean she didn't want to be queen. She never ever signed a document, that I'm aware of, renouncing her claim to the throne, but she did often cede her governing powers, by force at times and apparently willingly at others. Was she crazy as traditional stories recount? I think we've pretty much clarified that she wasn't, at least not in the way that the term loca conveys. Factors that may have led to psychological issues may include her tense childhood, clashes with her mother, a disappointing marriage, the loneliness of being cheated on in a faraway land where they probably made fun of her, the feeling of inadequacy instilled by her own family, sudden widowhood, being a mother of 6 children she barely saw, queen of a country she hardly ruled, a victim of heartless politics, separation from 2 children against her will, decades of separation from the rest of her family, and isolation. Is it any wonder, that she was affected by such a life? It does seem apparent that there were some aspects of her personality that made her particularly vulnerable to the life experiences she went through, and that they compounded with time. There also may have been something clinical there too. Lots of diagnoses have been put forward, but who knows? One thing I think is obvious is that we should stop referring to her as La Loca. Why does she get that term when scores of royalty and rulers over the centuries have been much worse and no one has earned anything remotely similar? Felipe V of Spain, for example, was far more in need of therapy than she ever was. In fact, he probably could have done with double sessions, and yet no one mentions that. Juana had a complicated life as it was, enough to make anyone's mental health suffer. And to make matters worse, an unfair and cruel, if you ask me, nickname has stuck with her ever since. So let's do her a favor and just call her Juana the First from now on. And that'll be all for that story, split into two parts. One day I'll try to put it together and turn it into one. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast by Brian Spain Domain. Please feel free to leave us with any comments because we love the feedback. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Amazon, Castos, and if you wish to support us, check us out on Patreon. You can find the link below. Stay well, stay safe, and hasta pronto.